probably Duke and Abacab, because you can link them together, are two very important albums for us, because we did a bit of a rethink, I think. And it started with Duke.
We were trying to write singles for years. You know, we were putting Carpet Crawlers out, I Know What I Like, The Lamb Lies Down, which songs that we thought were singles, but nobody ever played them because A, we were unknown, and B, we were branded as an album group. But nowadays, our 3 or 4 minute songwriting ability has got better.
Hi, I'm Mike Rutherford.
Hi, this is Phil Collins of Genesis here in the studio for Duke and Abacab.
A Band at a Crossroads, Part 1. Following their seventh album, The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, in 1975, British band Genesis lead singer Peter Gabriel leaves. The band auditions over 400 singers before giving lead vocalist duties to their own drummer, Phil Collins. Now, Genesis had been a cult group up to that point, largely because of Gabriel's theatrical approach in costumes, selling more concert tickets than albums. Admittedly, drummer Phil Collins had not given any indication up to then that he could be a frontman for Genesis.
No, I felt my strength was the playing and also the arranging. I did write bits and pieces, you know. I wrote things that were choruses or things that were verses or just little riffs and stuff. So I definitely was, you know, a part of the writing process. Probably not anywhere near as strong as I am now.
In an interview with Hugh Fielder in October 2004, Genesis keyboard player Tony Banks says, and I quote, "People look back on that first era with a rosy glow, and there was a lot of great music, but we weren't selling many records. Trick of the Tail, the first album with Phil Collins singing lead, doubled our sales," end quote. Fielder goes on to point out that for a band that was $400,000 in debt when Peter Gabriel left, this was good news financially as well as artistically for Genesis. But when lead guitarist Steve Hackett left in 1977, I wondered if the remaining three considered calling it quits. So I asked guitarist, bass player Mike Rutherford, and singer, drummer Phil Collins.
I said Peter's a great writer, but he was part of a team in Genesis. It's always been that way. So in the band, we knew that there was still a strong writing team. And we did question ourselves as to whether it was time to stop. I've always had a fear of carrying something past its natural finishing date. So we said, you know, maybe this is the time to stop. But then we thought, well, there's a good writing team here. Let's have a go. It's our attitude. Let's write some songs and see what happens. And basically, we never looked back.
See, by the time someone leaves, you know, you'll feel good about them leaving because the vibe has been around that they were going to leave, and you're so pleased to see them go that it's a weight off your mind in a way. It's not a shock. I probably feel less involved with Steve leaving and less involved with Steve's part of the group than I do with Peter. I mean, Steve was definitely an important part of the group, but I wasn't as close to that part of Genesis that he brought in. Yeah.
From the 1978 album And Then There Were Three, that's Genesis with Follow You, Follow Me, a pivotal song in the Genesis saga. It was their first American Top 25 hit, and the album And Then There Were Three becomes their first gold record. Creatively, the fact that Follow You, Follow Me was a collaborative songwriting effort by all three members would point the way for huge success in the future. But that's not to say that individual contributions were discouraged. Mike Rutherford still recalls the first time Phil Collins played him a song that Collins had written called Misunderstanding.
Yeah, and he played it and it sounded great. Very up, very, I like that, very sort of positive song. Very happy too, and it's very hard to write uplifting songs. You know what I mean? It's great to write sad songs, doomy songs, moody songs, but to write happy songs is much harder.
There was a song called Sail on Sailor by the Beach Boys, which is one of my favourite songs. And I loved that groove, and I wanted to write a song with that kind of groove. So that's how Misunderstanding developed. And also Hold the Line by Toto was another one of my favourite songs, and that kind of a similar kind of groove. I mean, similar kind of rock shuffle, if you like. So that's where that started from, and lyrically, Misunderstanding is really nothing to do with my face value collection of songs. It was nothing to do with my personal life or anything. It just seemed to work. The lyrics seemed to work with the song.
From the 1980 Genesis album Duke, that's the breakthrough hit Misunderstanding, which went all the way to number 14 in the U.S. Here's the composer, Phil Collins.
And it was a very unlike a Genesis song at the time, and that was our first big hit in the States. It brought us to a much wider audience. There was lots of youngsters in the audience for the first time, kids screaming, which was unheard of at a Genesis show. And of course, that did well for album sales for us, having a hit single. And suddenly people knew of Genesis. A lot of people that had never heard of Genesis before suddenly knew of our existence, which was strange for us to think because we've been going around for 10, 12 years at that point.
Guitarist and bass player Mike Rutherford.
Probably Duke and Abacab, because you can link them together, are two very important albums for us because we did a bit of a rethink, I think. And it started with Duke. Going back to early Genesis, the first few albums, we wrote it as a group. We went in there and just wrote the songs all together as a group. That was how the whole albums were done. Trespass, Nursery Crime. And as the time went on, when Peter left, I think we got a shock because everyone suddenly thought, who wrote what? So we credited it to a bit more to individual people. We got to then there were three, and suddenly we thought, why are we in a group? We're writing, you know, I'm writing this song, he's writing that song. You know, you two play on my song. It was becoming like individual songs being played by the group members. And that's not what Genesis was ever about. It was actually about writing together, not writing it individually and then arranging it. So Then There Were Three was the worst album for that criticism. Very much, this is my song, you two play on that, that's your song, we'll play on that. And at Duke, we started writing again as a band, which then led on to Abacab, which was a much easier album to make and was all about writing together. So I think those two albums are where we did a bit of a little shift.
Show.
Turn It On Again from 1980's Duke album by Genesis. It was a big hit in the UK at number 8 and helped propel the album to number 11 in America and their first number 1 album in their homeland. Next, Mike Rutherford and Phil Collins tell the story of the first Genesis album to go top 10 and sell over 1 million copies in America. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio for the anniversary of Abacab.
Welcome back to In the Studio with Genesis. I'm Phil Collins with Redbeard.
Thanks, Phil. Phil Collins was going through the separation and eventual divorce of his first marriage during the time before the Duke album was written.
We had got to the stage where Tony was bringing in songs, Mike was bringing in songs, I was writing with Mike. And we were becoming session players on each other's songs. And, you know, we're not necessarily getting totally involved in the particular song we were playing if it wasn't ours. Then my marriage broke up, and then I sort of said I was leaving to go and live in Vancouver. And the guy said, hang on, don't leave. Let's just put things on ice for a bit. We'll do our solo albums. Now, when they had finished their solo albums and I'd come back from Vancouver with nothing having changed in regard to my personal situation, I had a lot more time and energy for the group because it was something for me to do, you know, and my marriage hadn't repaired itself. So I was looking for things to channel my energies into. And with the solo albums, having used up Tony and Mike's material, we were stuck without a lot of stuff. But without that much material, we did start writing together, more like the old days with Genesis, when we did just sit down like The Lamb Lies Down and just sit and improvise for hours until something came. And songs like Turn It On Again, Duchess, Duke's Travels were the strongest things we've done, Behind the Lines. Great, strong group material, and we thought, this is what we do best. Tony and Mike had their first solo albums. I was doing mine. Let's do it. Let's treat Genesis a bit like this. And so they moved into my house. You know, that's where we moved all the furniture out, and that's where we rehearsed and recorded some of the Duke album.
Guitarist and bass player Mike Rutherford.
Yeah, he'd bought a house in Guildford, and I think he hadn't done the upstairs up properly, and there was a room which actually was a good-sized bedroom, and we used that to write.
We'd only lived, me and my wife and children, I'd only lived at this house for a few months before we split up. So we hadn't really settled in properly. So when I got my recording equipment, I moved the master bed, if you want, into the secondary bedroom and had the master bedroom as my studio, which was next door to the secondary bedroom. So we recorded a lot of stuff of the Duke album, just on 8-track. The noise was pretty loud, though. I think the neighbours, because Genesis were quite popular at the time anyway, and Guildford was a kind of a Genesis neighbourhood, it was like, it was accepted, it was just the boys, you know, the local boys are playing. Welcome back to In the Studio with Genesis. I'm Phil Collins with Redbeard.
Thanks, Phil. This is the anniversary of Abacab, the first Genesis album to sell over 1 million copies, released September 1981. Guitarist and bass player Mike Rutherford thinks the Duke and Abacab period is a turning point creatively as well as commercially for Genesis.
We go in the studio without any material and just do it in there. So we don't take songs or bits in. We go in with a blank piece of paper. Day one, it's like, well, just if it doesn't work, it's scary. If it works, it's great. The day may come when we get in there and it's like, you know, well, what are we going to do now? We just improvise and it all seems to happen in the first week. It just sort of takes off, but I don't mind that edginess to it. It's quite nice. But we do it for so long that it falls in quite easily. The back of my mind, the next album we go in, you always think, well, we could sit there day one and make coffee and talk, sit there day two, make coffee. And, you know, you can't guarantee it's going to happen. I can't see why it won't, but I don't sit down and feel safe. I don't feel secure. It's not a bad thing. I mean, I don't mind that either. There's always that, I wonder if, you know, an Abacab was when we started to get back into that way of writing. The songs, really, Abacab, No Reply, and Keep It Dark, and Lurker, were the ones I felt that were the best on that album. And they're the ones that we wrote fairly spontaneously.
A lot of our studio albums I never really enjoyed listening to that much. Something happened in the mix, and I've never been quite sure. Well, I know why it is. We weren't very good in the studio, I guess.
But the funny thing is, whenever we rehearse, we make cassettes, everything onto cassette, just so we've got a record of everything we've done. The band sounded the same for the last 20 years. And Abacab was the first time that we sounded on record close to how we sound when we play.
you're looking through me like I wasn't here at all. No reply, there's no reply at all. Dance with me, you never dance with me. Ooh, it seems that I can move. I'm close to you, close as I can get. Yet there's no reply at all. There's no reply at all.
Genesis from 1981's Abacab album with No Reply at All, marking the first appearance of a real horn section on a Genesis song. But brass was nothing foreign to Phil Collins, who had used the incomparable Earth, Wind, and Fire horns on his Face Value solo album, which had come out between the Genesis albums Duke and Abacab.
We tried to get a horn section sound on Duke, on Behind the Lines. On the Genesis version. And we didn't think of asking real horn players, so I had a duck call that I used like into a microphone, which triggered a vocoder, and we got a horn sound, right? And then on my album, I used the real guys, you know, the real Earth, Wind, and Fire guys. And when we were doing No Reply at All, it just sounded like it could have horns on it. And I said, why don't we get some horns? You know, we're changing everything else about what we do. Why don't we try that too? That would make people think, Earth, Wind, and Fire horns with Genesis? I've got to listen to this. I've got to check this out. You know, and it was kind of taking people off automatic pilot. Whatever they thought of Genesis, we were trying to just shake them a bit and say, no, we're not quite what you think we are. We may be something different. Check it out.
People late.
That's called Paper Late, recorded during the Abacab sessions, but it didn't fit on the vinyl record. So it appeared on the UK EP called 3x3, and in the US in 1982, it came out on the double album Three Sides Live. We took it off the 3CD Platinum Collection. To ensure that the collaborative songwriting approach was followed, Mike Rutherford revealed the Genesis Method. And listen carefully to this next confession from Phil Collins, plus a revelation from Mike Rutherford.
We were running the risk of becoming predictable if we just carried on the same way. So we just decided to put some tripwires in front of each other. And so when we were writing, we went through lots of different changes. You know, we started using drum machines to write with and improvising more, taking the Duke approach one stage further. But more importantly, probably stripping back the sound.
We were becoming a caricature of ourselves. And we hit the Abacab sessions, and we just thought, to hell with it. We threw all that stuff out and just worked on the stuff that felt a bit different. And I think it's that that makes Abacab a very important album. There are three bits of music in Abacab, and we refer to them as bit A, or section A, section B, and section C. And at different times, they're in a different order. We'd start with section A, and then have section C, and then have section... And at one point in time, it's spelled Abacab. In fact, the final version was not that at all. It's like Akakakabubaga. I mean, so...
I was curious if they gave any prior consideration as to how longtime Genesis fans might react to the new musical direction on Abacab. First Mike Rutherford, then Phil Collins.
No, I think it's very important, and this almost sounds rude to your fans. I don't mean that, but what I've always felt, it's so important that when you sit down to write an album, that you don't actually care at all about what your audience are going to think of the next batch of songs. Because if you do, you start worrying and pandering about it.
You know, I always say, when people say, why aren't you writing songs like In the Cage anymore? Why aren't you writing songs like Sabbath's Ready? I turn around to them and say, do you read the same books as you read 20 years ago? Do you wear the same clothes that you wore 20 years ago? Do you look the same as you did when you... Do you feel the same? And they always ought to obviously say, well, no. And I say, well, we don't write the same kind of songs because we are a reflection of what we are and what we do and what we read and what we listen to and all that kind of thing. So, of course, things will change. And maybe we've not been what that person thought we were in the first place. You know, maybe we were never a progressive rock group.
All you can do is to write what you like. And if you like it, the chances are most of them will, because they've liked it so far. That's always the way we've done it. And I've never, ever felt any loyalty in that sense. And if you follow me, it's not being at all rude. No. I've never felt I've owed them anything, any fans, in terms of the next album. I just got to write what I like. If they like it, great. If they don't, I'm sorry, because it's what I like.
great song from the September 1981 Genesis album, Abacab. That's Like It or Not. Phil Collins and Mike Rutherford return with one of the first acknowledgments of America's dirty little secret, homeless people. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio for Abacab, the first top 10 million seller in America by Genesis.
Welcome back to In the Studio. This is Mike Rutherford here.
Welcome back to In the Studio with Genesis. I'm Phil Collins with Redbeard.
Thanks, gentlemen. Abacab, the first Genesis album to sell over a million units in the U.S. It included a Phil Collins song called Man on the Corner, which undoubtedly was set to the most scaled-down arrangement that Genesis had ever done. Guitarist Mike Rutherford told me why in the studio.
I think it's the kind of song that you can't really do much to. It's a compositional song. It's the melody, the lyrics, and the chords. Add a drum machine in there, you can't really fiddle with it much. And it seemed obvious. It's very much a Phil song, more than some of the other sort of quieter songs we've done. But it sounded lovely, and we just kind of left it well alone, really. I think, you know, you get those kind of songs, you can't improve much. I think anything more would have spoiled it, really.
Waiting for, I don't know, but he waits every day now.
from 1981's Abacab. That's Genesis with Man on the Corner. Not the last time that composer Phil Collins would address the issue of homeless people and society's reluctance to acknowledge them or any responsibility for finding a solution. If you read critical reviews of the albums Duke and Abacab, many respected writers to this day still assume that because Phil Collins' solo career took off at that time, and because a band singer must also be its leader, that the other two members of Genesis unwittingly, if not unwillingly, followed Collins into the pop mainstream. Phil Collins is adamant that that's simply not true.
We never had a direction. We wrote songs, you know, and some of these songs were 10 minutes, some were 15, some were 20, some were 3. And if they sounded better, if an idea was right at 3 or 4 minutes long, you don't want to sort of milk it for everything it's worth. If an idea fitted in a 3 or 4 minute format, if you like, not that we thought of formats as such, but if it sounded better as a 3 or 4 minute song, then we would leave it like that. Other things like Supper's Ready, that you have ideas that don't necessarily have punchlines, and they drift into other moods, and then you have your 10-minute songs, 12-minute songs, whatever. And we were trying to write singles for years. You know, we were putting Carpet Crawlers out, I Know What I Like, The Lamb Lies Down, which songs that we thought were singles, but nobody ever played them because A, we were unknown, and B, we were branded as an album group. But nowadays, our 3 or 4 minute songwriting ability has got better.
So you see, the members of Genesis found it creatively challenging to say effectively in 3 minutes what had sometimes taken 23 minutes previously, all the while broadening their appeal immensely. Phil Collins and Mike Rutherford reminded me of the best reason for change.
What happens is that singles get so much visibility, airplay, MTV, videos, they're just so visible that people end up thinking that's what it's all about. We still write those kind of pieces, instrumental, longer pieces, and they still work, but they'll never be singles. Therefore, they get forgotten about in media terms. So people end up thinking, now you just make singles, which is kind of off the mark. It doesn't bother me that much, but it's nice to mention that way, that that's why I think people get this image that we've actually changed, I think, more than we have. I mean, you know, we started off with the Beatles, Small Faces, Kinks, Who, Motown, you know, wonderful. You know, pop songs to me is not, people use it now as an ugly term, you know, to me, the Beatles are my all-time favourites, wrote the most wonderful pop songs. I've done that ever since, or tried to, and it's not easy. You know, to be honest, I'm looking back now and I'm realising that what we used to do was actually a wonderful cop-out, because you do these long songs and it means you take a small piece of music, 1 or 2 minutes. If you're doing a long piece, you just play it for 1 or 2 minutes and then segue to something else. You haven't got to develop it into a song, which is actually much harder. So although everyone thought it was very complicated doing long songs, in a way, it was an almost easier way to operate. I found that actually trying to take less music and turn it into a well-crafted song is harder.
Here's Genesis co-founder, guitarist, songwriter Mike Rutherford with me in the studio. When then it was announced that Peter Gabriel had left Genesis, we just knew it was over. I mean, it was over. So what did you guys think?
Well, it was actually the same perception in England, I'd say. It wasn't that far apart either. We thought, well, what you do is, you know, you don't worry about it too much because you can't change it. It's happened. And we thought, well, do we carry on? What do we do? We didn't really know. So we thought, tell you what, let's go and do some writing, and maybe that'll tell us whether it's going to happen or not, you know, which is the best way. A, it puts the decision off, and B, it's an honest approach. You'll just go and write some songs, and you'll go yes or no. Anyway, as it coincided, you know, the first couple of days, Steve was doing promo for his solo album, so just myself and Tony and Phil, and we wrote Dance on a Volcano and Mr. Squonk, and we sort of, by day three, we were like, well, I don't care what the world thinks, this feels strong, you know.
Drummer Phil Collins had done an uncanny vocal performance, much to the startled delight of Genesis fans, the songwriting surprisingly strong, and the arrangements more powerful. Again, Mike Rutherford.
Well, the two things that helped us was obviously the album was good. It was a good album, Trick of the Tail. But then the fact, like you said, the fact that Phil could sing the old songs and be so convincing. You know, his voice wasn't that like Pete's, really, but it almost sounded like it was,
it really
but it wasn't.
Did. It really did.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, his original stage background in the theatre world helped him, because actually he had that sort of frontman position in his head already. this is going to work. But you really felt a warmth from the audience. You know, they were on our side.
With Steve Hackett on lead guitar, what were you responsible for in the arrangements?
I've always been really the chord man in the middle. I mean, from really early days, right the way through, really, you can hear the sort of the chords I play and Tony playing against me. Things like Squonk, you know, it's just sort of all about chords, and Dance on a Volcano is my 12 strings and Tony. That's part of a sort of a part of a makeup, really, I think.
What special hardware and guitars did you require to pull this stuff off in concert back then?
Well, there wasn't much gear to be. There wasn't much choice in those days, as you well know. You know, I just had a double neck guitar because the Genesis songs basically were often, you know, kind of a long song. So I was changing guitar every sort of minute and a half, or I got the double neck and the bass pedals, and then suddenly we had two. With the bass pedals, we had two guitarists, basically myself and Steve, and a bass player. So that kind of gained a member of the band, really.
Is it true then that Mike Rutherford invented multitasking?
No, that's for drummers. That's much harder. I'm just three. I'm two feet and two arms. That's a bit, yeah.
I mean, the PA systems were steam powered, and there were no effects, and there were no tricks, and there was no place to hide.
It was slightly easier because you had limitations and a lot less choices. So you had to make what you had work and be a bit more inventive. You know, nowadays you do record a song. People spend days trying to find a keyboard sound. You know, there's about a million choices. In those days, the options are quite small, so you have to decide and make it work quite early on, quite quickly, which meant the music sort of went a bit faster. Absolutely, and we didn't think for a long time Phil would ever leave the drums, you know. In his mind, drummer's the proper job. Singing's, like, not quite the same thing. And so we tried people out. It's funny, it was here there in front of us. We couldn't quite see it, nor could he, actually. So we did the album, and that sounded pretty good. And then we thought, well, who live? And so he came one day and said, well, look, shall I try singing live? Which surprised me, because actually I wasn't sure he'd ever leave the drums. And so he did, and as you know, it kind of worked.
Talking with founding member, guitarist-songwriter Mike Rutherford, I quoted a passage from his memoir book, The Living Years. I've always thought that half of the point of being in a band is that the guys you're playing with are different to you. End quote. How so?
Well, that's really what being in a band is about, is what co-writing is about. You know, you don't want to play with someone else who's like you, because that's just, you do what you do. So in a way, I think co-writing, and, you know, I've always been a natural fit for a band member, because you gain something with other people, which you can't do on your own.
Another quote, songwriting was and is still the area in which I measure success. Why is that so important to you, and what metric do you use to measure that success?
Well, I think, as I said in the book, that's really what gets me going. You know, that's what excites me. It's why I'm in the business. It's why I do music. The songwriting is really the key. I love playing live. That's great, but it comes after recording. And, you know, the world is full of wonderful instrumental players. And I'm really a guy who writes songs and then plays the guitar part for that song. And I judge it really by, it's actually how much it moves me. You know, when you're a songwriter or a musician, you've got to be selfish. You can't worry about the audience not being unfair. Otherwise, you start trying to do what they want to hear. If something excites me and moves me, then I've achieved the right thing.
Genesis singer, songwriter, drummer Phil Collins.
We haven't concentrated on singles or anything. We just still write music. I mean, Tony Banks is still very uninterested in you know, making hit records. And I don't set out to make a hit record. I just set out to write a song.
Again, Phil Collins.
So a song like Your Own Special Way, for instance, that was right next door to Unquiet Slumber for the Sleepers and In That Quiet Earth, you know, all the instrumental things, and the one for the Vine. It kind of fitted in beside it, because that's what we wrote. I mean, we didn't sort of say, well, let's write a song that's going to be an airplay single and get people's attention that way. It was indicative of the kind of thing we were doing. We were doing stuff that was actually quite listenable and stuff that demanded a lot of attention.
Building a small cult following to a medium-sized cult following, it's a good apprenticeship, you know, really, I think, and some great music. And then in a funny way, I think, you know, the subsequent changes with Steve leaving and then Peter leaving, in a funny way, although they're not looked for, when they happen, you use it as a sort of new, a kind of revamp, you know, each time.
Hypothetically, if Genesis had scored an international hit like Yes did with Roundabout in 72, or Pink Floyd did with Money in 73, do you think Genesis would have survived Peter Gabriel's abdication after The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway?
Well, I haven't had my first time asked this question. Possibly not, but then again, we're bloody stubborn. You know, adversity doesn't really spoil us. And what happened with Phil, I think actually was in fact not so much the fact that it worked. I think because he came from the band, the crowd wanted it to work. You really felt the first few shows of that tour, Trio Tail Tour, that the audience, because they knew Phil and liked Phil, they were on our side. They wanted it to work. And so I think that's unusual. Normally, you replace someone with a new face from outside. Phil was from in-house. I think it made a big difference.
Tell me, what else have you all been collaborating on?
We've done this documentary, which is basically called Genesis Together and Apart. Now, the key behind this was that they were on about making The Lamb, and I said, look, there's a better story to be told, which is that, you know, people don't really realize that from this one school band, Genesis, you've got the Gabriel career, the Collins career, the Mechanics career. People often separate it. And you put it all together and you sort of go, you know, you hear a sort of, I don't know, Turn It On Again or a Biko or In The Air or Living Years, and you kind of go, that's an amazing collection of compositions. And when you put it together, it's quite nice to just remind people, actually, that the variety of songwriting we've had over the years. And so the documentary is basically, it's about that, and the five of us meet together and talk and chat about it. I think it's got a bit of warmth and a bit of humour in it, too. It's a nice story, and it just tells the story of the whole band.